Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello, folks. Yesterday, we brought you our interview with Pam Shriver, in which she talked so movingly about the relationship she'd had with her first coach, all the trauma that that had brought her. And I think you'll agree that it was an immensely powerful, important listen. Well, today, we're speaking to Steve Simon, the chief executive of the Hologic WTA Tour. Steve has been leading women's tennis since 2015. Before that, he was tournament director in Indian Wells. And recently, he's been at the forefront of the WTA's response to the disappearance of Peng Shuai, suspending all of the WTA's business in China until she's independently and verifiably confirmed to be safe, well, and able to speak without coercion. The WTA were also in the news yesterday, having put out a statement criticising the moves of Wimbledon and the LTA in Britain for banning Russian and Belarusian tennis players from their events in the wake of the ongoing invasion of Ukraine. So it's timely for us to be able to speak to Steve and ask him about those subjects and a number of others. So here's Steve Simon talking to Catherine Whittaker here on the Tennis Podcast.
Well, first and foremost, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to do this. We've been wanting to speak to you for a while and we know how precious your time is and we're very grateful indeed. I want to speak to you first about the story that Pam Shriver told us on the podcast this week, an incredibly difficult and moving story to listen to. I know Pam called you to tell you she had done this interview with us and decided to tell that story. What was your reaction when you got that phone call? What went through your mind?
Well, first of all, it's good to be here. And when I did receive the call from Pam, the first thing that went through my mind was the amazing amount of strength it takes to come forward with this. And I reflected to Pam that she should be applauded for the courage to do so. You know, it's she did it, as I think she reflected to you in your discussions, from a place of wanting to make a difference with her story for others. And it's just aligned with who Pam is and what she stands for. She's truly a very, very special person, and the strength and courage that she reflected coming forth and with the story that she's told and she shared with all of you is something I think to be applauded. Not that the issues aren't the things you want to talk about, but to come forward with that, et cetera, should be applauded, because it is about helping us progress an area that's a challenge across sport, across society, in many, many different areas of our world.
Yeah. So in terms of that challenge, she details how concerned she is about the potential for boundary crossing today in today's game, inappropriate, damaging relationships developing. She thinks those relationships are happening today. Is that a concern that you recognize as well?
Oh, I mean, look, I think you have to recognize those concerns. As she reflected, the environment and the teams of professional athletes, if we just stayed a sport at this point in time, I think it does also apply to other parts of life as well. But in the world of sport, the teams are big. And I think she articulated it well when she reflected that it is about drawing lines and healthy boundaries around the entire team and the environment. So it's not just your team, it's the environment as well. You know, other players, the media, you know, how do you balance fans? How do you balance sponsors? You know, how do you balance all of those things? And there's a tremendous amount there to balance that makes for a healthy and productive player, for sure. And more importantly, a healthy and happy and balanced person that we want to see. So there's so much to be in this space. And, you know, I think that we're dedicated to ensuring that we do have a very healthy and safe environment for everybody to be in. There's a tremendous amount of work that's been done, and there's a tremendous amount of work that still needs to be done. You know, I think we're committed to it and committed to putting the resources towards that, to continue enhancing and progressing our ability to support players and staff and anybody in our environment in this space.
So what might that work look like? I mean, Pam had a few suggestions on the podcast. We've had a few responses from other players sort of suggesting various things. Education was a massive factor for Pam, education of players and of coaches about safeguarding. What's in place at the moment, and what do you want to do?
Again, we've done a lot of work in this space, and you know, we now have avenues and resources we didn't have when Pam was playing at the time. You know, we have a team on the ground just about every week, not every week, but just about every week. But even if they're not on the ground, they're available and have direct lines to them. We have educational resources that continue to be grown and expanded upon. We have, you know, confidential systems and procedures and a place for any player or person to come forward where they think that there's issues with respect to that, so that we can do the appropriate follow-up that's required based upon what we hear. And then again, it is about, making everybody comfortable that this is something you can come forward with. And that was something that Pam certainly focused on. And I think that's critical. If there isn't communication, if there isn't dialogue, if they don't feel comfortable that they can come forward and get help or ask questions or get support or whatever the issue might be at the time, then you're not going to get your arms around this, and you're not going to be able to help everybody in the manner that they should be. The other key element, I think, that really was a key element for us that's evolved since Pam was playing too, is the age eligibility rule, where we, again, are catching and working with these athletes at a very young age. Tennis is a sport where they come into this environment very young, and I think we've seen the benefits of that initiative as well. So it's a combination of all of those things, not just one. It's all of those things that continue to help us evolve this very important program.
And what about on the non-player side of things? Because one of the things that struck me about Pam's story and sort of a quite universal element of it is the fact that when you're in that situation, you might not recognize it as unhealthy or abusive. Pam talked about the fact that at the time she wouldn't have used the term abuse, but now it's only with the benefit of reflection that she sees that situation for what it was.
Yeah. Well, look, the whole area in this one, and it's obviously one of those unique spaces because it keeps expanding. It used to be based upon abuse. You know, was it sexual? Was it physical? Was it some other form of verbal abuse, etc.? It's also now evolving into psychological areas as well, and emotional areas as well. So it's continuing to expand, which is fine, and that's healthy because we're truly getting to all of the areas that create issues for people, which I think is something we have a responsibility to try to address. You know, I think that the key here is, and one of the things that we're looking on, especially from an education standpoint, is that as our teams and the amount of people in the environment have grown, we are looking at some programs where obviously as people get credentialed and get approved to come on into the environment, There'll be different forms of education that they'll have to complete before they can become accredited based upon the category. And I hate to use the word category, but based upon what they're coming into the environment as. Are you coming in as a coach? Are you coming in as a trainer? Are you coming in as a mental health person? Just a support person? I mean, there'll be different forms of education that they're going to have to go through to make them aware of the issues and the concerns in this space before they can be accredited. So it's a program we're working on. It's not complete yet, but we hope to have it implemented, hopefully as early as the start of next year. That becomes not just generic safeguarding information and education that you traditionally see, but more specific to certain areas so that we can hopefully, again, make people more aware and educate them and hopefully, you know, continue to manage this situation, because it will always be there. The question is how do we manage it and how do we deal with it?
Yeah, Pam mentioned to me some safeguarding developments that she'd been made aware of within the WTA that we're planning to launch at the start of next year. Is that what she would have been referring to?
It could be. I mean, there's a lot of initiatives that are out there that we're working on as we speak to, and these could have been the areas that she was referring to. You know, we will continue to evolve them and continue to explore them and continue to work on how do we bring the entire sport together as well, because our athletes go in and out of different groups. You know, we have ITF players that play some ITF events and then come into WTA events. We have players that play in the Grand Slams and WTA events. So we're going in and out of a lot of different areas. And so it's something that we're working on as to how do we continue to create these programs that's consistent through the entire sport platform versus just being a WTA effort or just being an ITF effort or just being an ATP effort. And we're having a lot of conversations in the sport to see how we can bring everybody together in this very important space.
Just finally, that on that, one of the things that strikes me is that while it's obviously very important to have the reporting channels available to players and to coaches for those that might be involved in those sorts of relationships, what about external reporting? If those within those relationships might not recognise them at the time for what they are there channels for concerned external parties to report and for that to be acted upon?
Sure. Yeah. No. Look, we're not going to ever close the doors to information that can help us address issues. I think if you're going to go that way and become, you know, very, very, I don't know, I don't want to say in a cylinder per se, but oblivious to the outside world, that's not going to help you address these various issues. And we have avenues. If somebody sees something, that they can certainly come to us and share what they have. The key to this whole area, again, is, as we said, is comfort and communication. And if we don't know what's going on, you can't address it. And the worst thing that could be there is the I don't know or I didn't know situation. And we were doing everything to keep every option and everything available so we can find out and we can hopefully address the situation appropriately.
Would the WTA ever make moves to intervene in a relationship that raised red flags from the outside, even if neither of the two parties involved were reporting anything themselves?
Look, I can't get into what each issue might be and everything. All I can do is say that, you know, anytime we receive information, we will address it and look at it properly and go through the process.
Okay. I appreciate that, Steve. It's obviously such an important issue and one that is being taken seriously, which is very good to hear. It's obviously been a very busy few months in the tennis world, which seems to be sort of constantly intersecting at the moment with real world events. It's sort of impossible to treat, you know, the whole sport and politics thing seems to be just so out of the window now. Yesterday, we obviously had the announcement that Wimbledon and the LTA would be banning all Russian and Belarusian players from their events. We've had the WTA statement on the matter, which is pretty forceful and clear-cut in terms of the organisation's stance. What was your reaction to that announcement yesterday?
You're right. You know, we've been going through a period of time and people take the position that sports and politics shouldn't match and shouldn't be intertwined, etc. But that's not reality. At times, sports does cross into politics. And here's a situation where politics is crossing into sport. And it is real life, as you reflected. And sports and entertainment and everything we do every day is all going to be intertwined one way or the other. And it's not usually good when it happens, but it is reality and you have to deal with it. The announcement that came out yesterday was extremely disappointing, to say the least. The one thing that this sport has always actually agreed upon, we don't agree on a lot of things, but the one thing we've always been united on was that entry into our events, and I say our events, whether it's ITF, ATP, WTA, Grand Slams, doesn't matter, has always been based upon merit and without discrimination. It's the one thing that we've been able to agree upon as a sport. And we've never, ever had denied an athlete from competing in any of our events due to where they're from or what decisions their government may have made, no matter how reprehensible they may have been. The issues that we're seeing in the Ukraine are reprehensible. We can't condemn what's happening there strongly enough. It's affecting all of our athletes and tennis family that are from the Ukraine, and we can't begin to understand the depth of their emotions and what they're going through. And we also, in fairness, the Russian and Belarusian athletes who have nothing to do with it, which everyone agrees, and they've come out and been outspoken against it, many of them, very strongly, in fact, you know, they're being affected as well. They have family that's back in those areas that are affected by it. They're feeling isolated and picked out as, you know, and treated differently. And it's simply just not right. I mean, there has to be a balance here. And we feel very, very strongly and took the position earlier in the year that these athletes need to continue to be able to play. They should not be penalized based upon the actions of their government. We stay strong behind that. I will not back off of that. I feel it's a fundamental principle. And in these tough times, when you have principles, if you're not willing to stand up for those, you don't have principles at the end of the day. And that's when things get tough, for sure. I think that, unfortunately, in this situation, the athletes are being asked to take the burden for things that are beyond their scope. And again, this is where politics has come on in and allowed these athletes to be taken the burden of politics. And I don't think it's fair. We don't support it. And it's against our rules. So we are going to be evaluating what our next steps are. Our boards and councils will be coming together in the next week. And we will determine our next steps. But I couldn't be more unhappy with the decision and disappointed in the decision that's come forth.
There's kind of two separate strands, it sounds to me here. There's the principle of the matter and there's the rules. So just to pick up on what you said there about the rules, my understanding is that the LTA decision and the AELTC decision fall into slightly different categories. Maybe Wimbledon have slightly more leeway to take their stance than the LTA do. Is the LTA's current stance in violation of the WTA rules, and are measures available to the WTA to act against that?
Well, actually, both of them are in some ways very similar. The Wimbledon decision is against the Grand Slam rules. It's in violation of Grand Slam rules, as well as the Grand Slam agreement that we have with respect to the Grand Slams. So it's in violation from our perspective in both of those situations. The LTA, which has sanctioned events, WTA sanctioned events, the decision is in violation of the WTA bylaws and rules with respect to entry of athletes. So we do have the ability, to react to both of those. We don't have the same jurisdiction over the Grand Slams as we do, obviously, our own sanctioned events. We can react to them not following their rules, and we can react to the agreement we have in place with them that's in violation, and deal with what outcomes could come from there if they're decided to be acted upon. We also do have precedent where we have taken our own events, such as the LTA events in the past, where these situations may have occurred, where fines and sanctions placed upon their tournament sanctions have been imposed. So we will be evaluating how we proceed in both of those areas.
In terms of the reaction, how you've mentioned sanctions there, how extreme are the options on the table? Would a boycott be discussed? Would that be in the conversation of a potential reaction?
I'm not going to go into, you know, what the various areas could be. I think that's premature, because we need to sit down with our tournament, our player councils, and as well as our board, and see where everything's at, because obviously what you just described begins to affect a lot more people than just the current affected people. So I think all of those things are going to have to be evaluated, and we're going to have support. I do think that you'll see some strong reactions that will come from us. But again, what those are and how far that they'll go is still to be determined.
And will those WTA discussions, will they be happening in tandem with the ATP? Because obviously their stance, they might have worded their statement slightly differently, but their stance is reflective of yours, or will independent reactions take place in the two bodies?
Well, we're required to have independent reactions. So that'll be for sure, is that they'll be independent. Have we been in conversation with them, and will we continue to communicate with them? Yes. The sport, unlike maybe a lot of people think, we do talk a lot, and we do talk amongst all the groups a lot. So yes, there will be communication between us, but again, they have to be and will be independent decisions, of course.
Just finally on this topic, obviously it really seems to be a decision that has completely divided, not just tennis fans, but political commentators, all of it. It's very divisive. And many people agree with the WTA and ATP stance. But what would you say to Elena Svitolina or Marta Kostyuk, who have both spoken so bravely and so powerfully about the situation, and have sort of made the point that, you know, in this case, while the means are not very subtle and they do come with unintended harsh consequences, the ends justify those means. What would you say to that?
We've spoken about it, and they've obviously come to me with those concerns that you're reflecting, which are very fair, and I understand them. I do understand them and respect them. And if I'm from the Ukraine and my home is no longer there, and I have family and friends that are still there, or that we've lost them at this point in time, you can only imagine what the emotions would be. The difference is, and where we've come out and we've advised them with it, I'm not saying that they 100% agree with the position, but we've taken it, and we will continue to, is, again, the fundamental principles of this is that we have never excluded a player from being able to play based upon where they're from and what decisions that their government may or may not have made. this situation isn't changing that at this point in time. We think it's fundamental that they all should be provided the opportunity. We need to work through the emotions. We need to work through the issues. But again, these are people that don't believe in the conflict that's going on as well. And we don't feel that they should be penalized as a result of that as an independent athlete.
There are, as I kind of said in preface to this section of the chat, there are just so many ways at the moment that tennis is intersecting with the world and with politics. Obviously, we'll come on to talk about China and the WTA's much praised, very strong stance on China. How do you choose which battles to fight? Because there are so many to choose from.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's choosing. I think you fight the battles that are brought to you and when they affect you and your members. The WTA has never taken a position of going out and fighting the world's geopolitical issues. The issues that we take on are when they affect our members directly, our athletes and our tournaments. Then we will take a very strong stance, and we have a principled stance. And I think that the issues that you're seeing, obviously, the one we just discussed about whether a Russian player should be able to play or not, as well as the issues that we've addressed in China, these are issues that are directly affecting our members. And we're following our principles and the basis upon which the WTA was built upon and what we stand for, which is providing for opportunity and providing for change. And we address the issues accordingly as they address us and as they have a direct effect on us. And I think it has served us well so far. But again, we're not afraid to take strong stances, et cetera. And again, we do try to keep sport out of politics until it's something you can't do because it is involved. Sport and politics have been mixed in some of these issues. And we'll continue to be consistent in that space because I think you have to be. You can't decide one time you're going to be principled and the next time you're not. Either you believe in this and you stand for it or you don't. And we will stay that way.
What's your understanding of Peng Shuai's current situation? What's the latest you heard from her or of her? What methods of communication have been tried? What's the situation in terms of how you understand it?
Yeah, we continue to work in the space. We've said from the get-go this would be a long process, and it's going to be a long process. We have not had any recent communication with Peng, and the world has not seen Peng since the Olympics either. So I think it's clear what we were seeing through that period of time. Because I think, you know, obviously the IOC and the Chinese government were working on making sure to use that as a statement. We remain dedicated to finding a resolution to this. We want to find a resolution that Peng could be comfortable with, the Chinese government can be comfortable with, and we can be comfortable with. You know, when you take on issues like this, it is about finding a resolution. We're not about walking away from China. We have suspended our operations there right now. I mean, our events right there, which we said we would do, and we'll continue to do that till we get to a resolution. But it isn't about never going back to China. It's about how do we get to a resolution? Because I don't think you make change in this world by walking away from issues. You have to create change. It might not be everything we want, but we have to find a solution that, again, finds that balance that I just described that allows us to go back and see progress in the area. One of the things that WTA brings when we go into these regions is we do begin to create great opportunities for women. We have been able to create a lot of exposure for women's rights and growth and opportunity, which is what this is about. So you're going to run into the issues that we're facing in China when you do that. And you have to be part of the solution. So we want to be part of the solution. But we're also going to, you know, not allow it to be pushed aside because it's too difficult. And, you know, we will stay resolute. And again, we do hope to be back there in 2023 with a resolution that shows progress was made in the space. And I think that's a victory for the world if we can accomplish that.
We're hearing a lot of the words Tennis United at the moment, which is music to the ears of anybody invested in tennis. I think, you know, more closer relations between the various bodies is, I think, universally desirable. But in practice, the ATP haven't suspended any of their tournaments in China, and in fact seem to be, if anything, expanding their presence there, which is a very different stance to the WTA that doesn't feel very united. Is that an issue for you?
Well, as I said earlier in the discussion, the sport, I think that the communication amongst the various entities within sport is at levels that we haven't had before. I'm not saying we're all getting along, and Wimbledon and this issue is a good example. But we are communicating more than we ever have, and we're doing more together than we ever have. It's hard. It's not easy to pull all these different groups together, but the effort is there. You know, on the ATP side, their difference is that for us, we had one of our members that was affected. They don't have a member that's affected there. They'll have to make their own decisions at this point in time. Would we love to have their support of what we're standing for there and the issues? Absolutely. But again, these are decisions that they have to make. We're not trying to influence their decision in any way. It has to be theirs. And again, I think it's part of, you know, of the approach. This is our member. And that we're dealing with, and it's not their members. So they're looking at this through a different set of eyes.
So no WTA events in China in 2022. What will the second half of the season, which traditionally would see a lot of Chinese events, what's that looking like?
It's actually coming together very well. We worked with our members and wanted to come to a decision early in the year, whether we would be able to operate it or not. We made the decision early that, you know, no matter why we're still trying to resolve the situation, even if it's resolved, we wouldn't operate again until 23 so that we could build a fall calendar. I'd say in the next 2 to 3 weeks, we'll have an announcement which will reflect a fairly solid fall calendar. We've made a lot of great progress in that space. A lot of credit goes to the members, our promoters within the China region that have been working on helping us move these events around. It's been a cooperative effort, which has been great. And I do think we'll have a very solid fall calendar. There's still a lot of work to be done in the space, but we'll have a good fall calendar.
John Wertheim reported today that the finals won't be going back to Mexico. Is that correct? Are we any closer to knowing where they will be going?
We're talking to several different regions and destinations right now that are interested in the finals. So I'm hoping in the next month or so we'll have a direction as to where they're going to go for 2022. Yeah.
In terms of the stance that the WTA has taken over China, how direct in terms of cause and effect was that situation with the Hologic sponsorship? How big a factor was that principled stance that you and the organization have taken in attracting Hologic?
Yeah. Well, first, we couldn't be more excited about a partnership than we have with Hologic. I don't think there's very many times where you have two brands that align in sponsorship like this, where things are such aligned with respect to your goals, and what you stand for and what you're working for. If it hadn't have been Hologic, I'm not sure we would have done an entitlement deal. But I think the alignment with Hologic and women's health and all of the elements that they stand for, we couldn't have a better partnership, and we're very excited about it. The China situation, I think, brought attention to them of the WTA. I don't think that they were thinking of the WTA at the time. So it certainly brought a level of awareness and interest in the organization. The issues and the stance that we've taken in the region was not the reason that they signed with us, but I do think it brought the awareness as to who we were and what we were about, which made them interested in having conversations with us. At the end of the day, the partnership has to work and the business has to work, and we have to be able to deliver against the investment that's being made. And they came to us and wanted to make a difference. And, you know, I do think that they're going to make a difference for us, both from a women's health and awareness situation, but also, you know, they wanted to make a difference in the organization. And we've already seen some very positive influences that have come from that and the initiatives that they're putting forth.
How critical is the financial injection that they'll bring, given the, you know, the financial impact of the chance on the stance on China?
There's no question it was significant. To show, you know, that they wanted to make a difference, they worked with us and allowed us to structure our agreement in a manner which allowed us to really create stability within the central organization, as well as it's allowed us to create growth in women's prize money and compensation, which is a critical element as well. They said they wanted to make a difference, and they have. It's been a significant partnership so far. We've felt the value of it tremendously. We certainly hope that they're seeing it as well. I think they are. But obviously, we've got, you know, 4 years ahead of us, and hopefully it turns into 40 years. You know, I think they've made a difference, and it's made a huge difference for the WTA.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
I think those are the big chunky topics covered, but just while I've got you, just a few other sort of bitty topics that I'd love to pick your brains on. On-court coaching is the first of those. Something that the WTA has, you know, really consistently stood behind. It was removed because of the pandemic. Do you want it to return? Will it be returning? What's the situation with that?
Well, we evolved on-court coaching to coaching being allowed from the side of the court versus coming on court. I'm a big proponent that I believe coaching's a part of sport. And I don't believe in hypocrisy. And we were being hypocritical that coaching wasn't happening before. Okay. And I think we are as a sport where it's not. We took the stance with on-court coaching to allow for it. And now we've, due to the pandemic, we stopped the on-court, but we have moved forward with allowing coaching from the side of the court. The direction that I see us going is not reinstating the on-court coaching, but continuing the coaching from the side of the court. I think it's worked really well. The players and the coaches like it. We've been able to do it in a manner that remains discreet. You don't see them shouting and yelling across the court and all of those things, which I think is important. But it's also created legitimacy because coaching has been happening in our sport for years, even though people don't want to admit it. We've seen instances where coaching has affected matches in negative ways, you know, when you said you weren't supposed to, et cetera. And I think it's, again, it's just part of the sport and just needs to be done well. So we remain big supporters of coaching. We think it works. We've done the trial now for a year and a half from the side of the court. We'll finish it this year. And I expect coaching to be on the WTA side, you know, going forward as we do. And will there be other evolutions of it? Well, certainly we'll look at it, of course. But I think this is the ultimately the right place and the right system to have, which we have now.
Okay. Well, one of the things we talk about a lot on the podcast is the inequality of format at Grand Slam tournaments, best of three versus best of five. We've argued that female tennis players are denied the same stage and exposure as male players, particularly in the latter stages of the tournament, because they don't get to play best of five. Are you, whatever the potential solution might be, and we can come on to that, are you comfortable with the current inequity in formats between men and women at Slams?
Yeah, no, this is not a new topic for sure. And as I've said before, and I'll be clear here, if we're going to have a topic about just pure equity due to time on court, we'll play best of five tomorrow. Okay. I think it's the wrong decision. I actually think best of five is an archaic approach, which needs to evolve. The sport has evolved as well. And I don't think consumers are going to sit there and watch and consume tennis matches on TV, et cetera, for 4 and 5 hours while those go on. And in fact, we know from the viewership, they have a tendency to watch the start of the match and the end of the match. Okay. You know, viewership time is about 90 minutes, you know, and I think that's, we need to be 90 minutes, 2 hours for our matches. The other thing that brings great concern to me, and it doesn't affect me, I'm not operating on the ATP side and probably have no reason to say this, but I'm concerned with athlete health. The game of tennis is so physical right now, and the athletes are amazing. And you can see these athletes breaking down as they get later in the tournament due to these long matches and not having appropriate rest in between. I think it hurts the flow-on effects of our tours because the players then can't play the other events because they're hurt and they're tired. And I think it's just a system that's gone away. There's a big difference between playing five sets today and when I played five sets. Okay. And it was a different game, different rallies, different strengths. And I think with the game has to change, and we have to change with the viewers as well. I know, I understand the ideas of the drama and the gladiator and, you know, the long match and the uniqueness of it, et cetera. I get it all. There's some great history there, but I think we have to evolve and, you know, we need to keep these players healthy. We want them playing more, not less. We want more excitement and more drama more frequently throughout the match. And I don't think five set matches is the answer to it. I do think we have to look at it. So from a WTA perspective, if we're going to talk about equality and equality has to go to time on the court, we'll play five sets tomorrow. I can guarantee you we're going to see more hurt players. Okay. Because again, it's just physically draining on them with today's style of play. And the quality of matches as well, because from the first round, you're playing five set matches. It's not like in the days where you had pretty easy matches in the early days. There was a big difference in the depth of tennis. So, look, if we want it, we'll do it. But I think it's absolutely the wrong decision and the wrong discussion.
So I have a proposition for you to end on, Steve, that I'd like your opinion on. Our proposal, which I see as a sort of compromise of all of those factors you've just discussed, reduce men's tennis to best of three for the first four rounds, same as women, and then both the men and the women play best of five from the quarterfinals onwards. So net reduction in tennis solves the scheduling issue week one, but also achieves equality. What do you think?
I think it's something should be looked at. I don't have an issue with it. One thing about myself is that I'm all for evolution and change. If you're doing the same thing that you've been doing, you're going backwards. We need to evolve. I think there should be a testing of it. You know, let's test it and see how it works and what are the issues with it, and test it in real events and see. You know, again, the question with it is, and I think it's where you would get into the valuation, is that if I go from best of three to best of five from the quarterfinals on, as you're describing, is my viewership going to go up because I go to best of five? And because I've got, so viewership's going to go up and the rights fees and the amount of money people are going to pay to do it go up, then let's have the conversation. If there isn't a change there, why are we putting the athletes at a bigger risk when now they might not be playing as much going forward? So I think we have to balance all of those things, but more than happy to look at it.
That's great to hear. Yeah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Fantastic stuff, Steve. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. I know you're a busy man with all these politics to deal with. But we really appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thank you. Okay. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah. Thank you.